Accession number 6380, roll number 2.
Sir John Colville, reel 2. You mentioned, just before we paused, Sir John, about the CWR, and I wonder if I can ask you now about the Prime Minister's use of the Cabinet War Rooms.
Yes. The Cabinet War Room was built, I think, just before the war, the map room and everything, and we used to get reports from the map room, CWR, and even in Neville Chamberlain's time. But it didn't come into full use, as far as the Prime Minister was concerned, until the Blitz began at the beginning of September 1940. A bedroom was prepared for the Prime Minister in the, as it were, the first floor of the CWR. Well, there were a lot of bedrooms below that, which were prepared for him as well, which was thought to be safer. And he did take a great deal of trouble about the security, because he had a passion for building, and I remember two or three times having to go with him in the evenings with torches down to where they were putting up travises and other brickwork in the basement in order to make the building stronger. And he used to go along and comment on them, and there was one great occasion when he climbed on up onto one of the travises that was being built and jumped down the other side, although he was in his late 60s, he was still pretty active, and landed in a pool of liquid cement, which I thought rather funny. And I looked over the wall at him and said, I think, sir, you've met your Waterloo. Whereupon he looked around and he said, my Blenheim, please. Anyhow, he did take great interest in it, but he didn't really like living there. He slept in his downstairs bedroom a number of times in September and early October 1940, but he really didn't start using the CWR very much, except for meetings of the Cabinet and the Defence Committee, until the annex, as it was called, the annex to 10 Downing Street, was built on the floor above, which was just above pavement level, in the what was then the Ministry of Works, or the Office of Works, is now I think the Ministry of Defence. And when that was converted into a really rather beautiful flat by Lady Churchill, who had the most marvellous taste, and even in wartime could make a bleak looking flat perfectly charming, when that had been done, he used to sleep there. He had a bedroom there, and he had a small office there, and Lady Churchill had her bedroom there, and they had a drawing room and a sitting room, and there were the private secretary's offices and so on. But as far as possible, he liked working at number 10, and it made life very difficult for the private office, because we never knew where we were going to be next, whether we were at number 10 or at the annex. And one was always running between the two, through the Foreign Office courtyard, up King Charles Street, through the courtyard, into Downing Street. So he liked being at number 10, which he liked the atmosphere very much. And so we never quite knew where we were, but it wasn't until the annex was ready, which was towards the end of October 1940, that the Churchill domestic, Churchill family's domestic home became the annex to 10 Downing Street. And that was not the CWR, it was the floor above the CWR. So he would go down, I think if I remember right, there was a lift, into the CWR in the evenings, or during blitzes, for meetings of the Cabinet, which very often happened at night, or the Defence Committee, which always happened at night. But in the daytime, except when there were very heavy raids going on, he would move over to 10 Downing Street, which is where the Cabinet would meet. The CWR was therefore in great use in September and most of October 1940. Whether it was much used during the doodlebug period, I don't know, because I was away in the Royal Air Force myself in 1944. But as soon as the bombing stopped in May 1941, then life started again at number 10. Although, because Lady Churchill said she really couldn't keep both number 10 and the CWR or the annex going, they continued to live at the annex and did so right up till the end of the war. In fact, it was in the map room at the annex, which wasn't the one in the CWR. Churchill had his own map room made on the same level as the annex itself, that's to say, a level above the CWR. It is in that that he watched the election results in July 1945. So he went on using it right up until the end of the war and beyond. Indeed, during the 1945 election campaign, his headquarters were still at the annex to number 10 Downing Street, although in the daytime they might be at number 10. He had the downstairs rooms, the typist's rooms at number 10, shored up with huge sort of wooden supports in them, and they were converted into a very pleasant dining room and drawing room and a bedroom for the Prime Minister, on the right, on the sort of, on the garden level at number 10, below the level of Downing Street itself.
When the Prime Minister was using either the CWR or the annex, where did you and the private secretaries work?
We had two lots of rooms. We had rooms in the annex, beyond the Prime Minister's rooms, because it was a long sort of flat. It went right round the corner and adjoined the cabinet offices. We had rooms there, one in which the two senior private secretaries worked, and another in which I and another private secretary and one of the clerks. We had three very able clerks, headed by a splendid man called Barker, and we worked there. And there were other rooms for typists along the passage, and the secretaries. And on the other hand, we also had our offices at number 10, which of course were used when the cabinet was meeting there, and so on.
I think you mentioned in your diary, Sir John, that Mr. Churchill actually had his meals at the CWR. On October the 17th, the entry states, dined at CWR.
No, that was not him. I dined at the CWR.
That's yourself,
that was me, not the Prime Minister. I don't think he ever had a meal downstairs in the what we call the mess at the CWR. I'm trying to think where he did dine during the Blitz. I think he went, yes, I'm sure he was stayed at number 10 for his meals, because there was the awful occasion when a bomb blew in the kitchen and he was very worried and ran downstairs to see if the cook was all right. That was certainly in October 40. I think he had most of his meals at number 10, bombs or no bombs, and went over to CWR in the evening. But I don't remember I'm sure he never dined or lunched at the CWR mess. Or indeed at the annex until it was ready at the end of October. He used sometimes to go to the Down Street tube shelter, which had been prepared by the Underground Railway executive, and had most comfortable accommodation and splendid rooms. He did go there, I should think, 7 or 8 times and spend the night there. When the things were very noisy, because he didn't really like his bedroom in the CWR, although he certainly did use it on a number of occasions. And I very well remember that he used it very often to rest. He'd had his afternoon rest. And I remember vividly going into his bedroom there one evening, and it's just when Neville Chamberlain died. And he was dictating to Mrs. Hill, one of his personal secretaries. He tended to use his personal secretaries for dictating and not the staff, not the typist at number 10. And he was dictating to her a very moving speech, which he made next day in the House of Commons about Neville Chamberlain. And that certainly was lying flat on his bed, looking, I think, not totally proper, because he did rather forget who was in the room sometimes. Lying on his bed there and dictating this beautiful piece of prose, which was a marvellous, really memorial speech to Neville Chamberlain. And that he certainly did in the in his bedroom in the CWR. He also, I think he dictated quite a lot from that room, quite a lot of his speeches, because he liked to lie in bed and dictate. Although I don't think, but I may be wrong, I don't think he broadcast from the CWR. He may have done so on one occasion, but normally he broadcast from a cabinet room at 10 Downing Street, where the BBC would bring their apparatus.
Right. You actually left the number 10 in autumn of 1941 to join the RAF. I wonder if you can tell me what prompted you to make that decision.
Well, just that I didn't like to be left out of the fighting. I thought, you see, one lived a very spoilt life in number 10. One had all these weekends at Chequers where there were diplomatic rations, which I had to be because the Prime Minister was always entertaining people. One lived, the Prime Minister himself couldn't do without his bottle of champagne for luncheon and for dinner, or his 12 or 15 cigars a day. And as he was very generous minded, he always gave them to his private secretaries too. So that I found I was living in the flesh pots, whereas all my friends and contemporaries were fighting. And I just didn't feel I could go on doing that. But of course, by that time, I was beyond the 25-year-old reserve. I was reserved. And I had great difficulty in getting out. But finally, with the help of Lady Churchill, Mrs. Churchill, she was then, and Brendan Bracken and one or two others, he was persuaded to let me go. And he did say to me at the time, well, I wouldn't let you go if you weren't joining the RAF, because the RAF is the cavalry of modern war. And so he let me go, and I really felt I simply couldn't bear to miss taking some part in action. So I became a pilot in the RAF. And then after 2 years, or a little bit more, but yeah, it must have been 2 years, about the autumn of 43, when I'd done my training in South Africa and come back, and just, it was a very slow process in those days, just got into an operational squadron flying Mustangs, I was sent for number 10, and Winston said it was time I came back. So I pointed out I'd only done one operational flight. Oh, he said, well, you can do six, and then you must come back. So I did five more operational flights, rather saying to myself, well, if I get killed on one of these five, it'll be a bit unlucky. And I came back number 10, just in time to find that the Prime Minister was thought to be dying. He was terribly ill, pneumonia, in North Africa. And I was still in uniform, sent to fly out with his wife to join him out there. Well, of course, immediately I was out there, we went on from Tunis to Marrakesh, I discovered about Operation Overlord. So I went back to my boss and said I couldn't miss the... I was now a trained pilot, and I couldn't miss the most exciting and largest warlike operation in all history as a trained pilot. And after he said to me, you seem to think this war is being fought almost exclusively for your own amusement. However, having got that one off his chest, he then said I could have what he called 3 months fighting leave, but no more holidays this year. So I was allowed to rejoin my squadron about 10 days before D-Day, for June, July, August 1944. And then I came back to number 10, my 3 months fighting leave being up, went off to Quebec conference with Churchill and remained with him until the end of the war.
When you returned, did you find there was a great alteration in his health?
No. Lord Moran made an awful lot of nonsense about that. You see, I think Lord Moran had to find an excuse for writing an inexcusable book. He told me that I had discovered he'd written it, and I asked him about it, and he said, well, I must, I have to make, when I die, my wife will have no money, I must provide for her. And I put in a book, which then I was made to take out on the grounds that it was libelous. But this was the most honourable reason for doing a dishonourable thing, because it was dishonourable for a doctor to write about his patient's health, particularly as he only saw him when he was ill. And the man, it wasn't, Churchill was tired, and who wasn't at the end of the war, but he wasn't really ill. The man who was ill, and it did make a lot of difference to what happened after the war, was President Roosevelt. Now, if Lord Moran or his American equivalent had written a thing about Roosevelt's health, that would have had some point. But Churchill really wasn't ill until in 48 he had a small stroke and another in 53. But he survived them remarkably well. And after all, he had a stroke in June 53 and went on as Prime Minister till April 51. And there was no more peaceful or happy or successful administration after the war than that between 1951 and 1955. So I think Lord Moran talked a lot of rubbish. And I think he did it because he wanted to write the book. He writes very well. There are a lot, as I pointed out when I reviewed it, there are a lot of minor errors in it. I mean, he can't really have written it in a diary every day, because when we were going off over on the Queen Mary, he called it the Queen Elizabeth. Well, if you were on board, you wouldn't do that. So he must have embellished it a lot afterwards. And, of course, he was never present when important discussions took place, except at meals. And quite often Churchill went, and in fact he always did go on talking at lunch and dinner on business matters. So he picked up a certain amount there. But again, in reviewing the book, I said, which I think is true, Lord Moran was never present when history was made, though he was quite often asked to luncheon afterwards. What he did do was to go and ask people like Lord Allenbrook and others what was happening and what happened, and then make notes of what they said in reply. But he really, I don't think his book is a thing that should be taken too seriously by historians, because it's not a truthful account of Churchill's state of health at that time. And this is a point which was made very strongly by Lady Churchill and by all the people who knew him well, General Ismay, Sir Edward Bridges, all of us. And that's why, at Lady Churchill's request, I organized the writing of a book called Action This Day, Working with Churchill, which was a reply to Lord Moran by six people, all of whom knew Churchill really rather better than Lord Moran, and certainly saw him much more of him.
Now, after he had lost the 1945 election, you actually remained on as a private secretary for a while.
I remained on with Attlee for about 3 or 4 months, because as a civil servant, one stayed on. Anyhow, Churchill and Attlee, Churchill I once asked Churchill some years after that which of his Labour colleagues he liked and admired the most in the war. I expected him to say Bevin, because I knew he was very fond of Bevin and thought very well of Bevin, but rather by surprise he said, oh, Attlee. I don't think they were attuned really to each other. They hadn't got the same sense of humour all the same, but they both respected and admired each other. And they each had a sense of humour to this extent, that when after the 45 election, the Tories went to town about a letter that Professor Lasky had written, and it became, and Churchill wrote to Attlee about it. I'd been lent to Churchill for a week to help clear up, and I drafted, he asked me to draft a reply to the letter that Attlee, whose private secretary I was, had written to him, which I did. And I took it back and handed it to Attlee, who looked at it and said, I bet you wrote this, so you can help me draft the reply to Churchill. So I did help draft two of the letters. In fact, I drafted one of them completely, the one from Attlee back to Churchill. But all that was looked upon as a jolly political knockabout. I mean, there was no ill will. Churchill told everybody that the people had decided and that it was the duty of the opposition to oppose, but they must be constructive. And Attlee lent Churchill his own Prime Minister's aeroplane, which they had in those days, to go away on a holiday. So, I mean, there was very goodwill between them.
So, Sir John Colville, thank you very much indeed.